loud and clear.
From the studios of Radio Sputnik in downtown Washington, D.C., it's Loud and Clear. We take you inside the news 5 days a week. It's happening, and it's happening now. I'm Walter Smolarek, filling in for Brian Becker, and joined in studio by John Kiriakou. In our first hour, we take a look at two big stories. First, the intense struggle over the budding peace process in Korea continued today, as President Trump said this morning that North Korea, quote, is no longer a nuclear threat, but a mobilization of the corporate media and a wide range of politicians in Congress is seeking to undermine the progress made in Singapore. And then we have our regular Wednesday segment, Beyond Nuclear with Kevin Camps, where we look at nuclear issues, including weapons, energy, waste, and the future of nuclear technology in the United States. Today, we'll continue coverage of a massive taxpayer bailout of coal and nuclear and the revelations that the regulators, NRC and FERC, have been meeting secretly. Stay tuned to hear this important nuclear coverage.
But before we get to those two stories, we'll go over today's headlines, including five that we'll cover in depth in the second hour. First, South Carolina Congressman Mark Sanford was defeated in the Republican primary yesterday by a state legislator who criticized him for not supporting President Trump strongly enough. Trump tweeted his opposition to Sanford just hours before the polls closed yesterday, and that appears to have been enough to seal his fate. Next, Republican leaders late last night managed to pull together a long-awaited immigration agreement that satisfied both moderates and conservatives. The agreement calls for votes next week on two different immigration bills, a conservative one that will likely be defeated, and one that the Republican leadership will write this week with input from both of their factions. Then the U.S. Senate is challenging President Trump by inserting language in the annual defense bill that would prohibit him from lifting sanctions on Chinese telecom ZTE. The company had agreed to pay a $1 billion fine and to allow American inspectors in after it was caught selling prohibited items to Iran and North Korea. And then in a victory for Amazon, Starbucks, and other major corporations, the Seattle City Council voted to repeal a tax that was meant to fund efforts to combat Seattle's homeless problem. The tax would have raised $47 million a year to fund affordable housing projects. And finally, in a major defeat for the Justice Department, a federal judge yesterday approved AT&T's $85.4 billion merger with Time Warner. It's a decision that is expected to unleash a wave of corporate mergers, beginning with CVS and Aetna Insurance. And in other headlines, in the days after the Red Cross and United Nations left the Yemeni port city of Al Hudaydah, Saudi Arabia and the UAE have attacked the port today. The port is important for Yemenis as it's where all food shipments arrive. The UN is warning that 250,000 residents could be affected. The Federal Reserve today announced that it was hiking interest rates, bringing the benchmark rate up to a range of 1.75 to 2%. This is just the seventh interest rate hike since the 2008 Great Recession. While this is the second increase this year, interest rates remain at historically low levels as central banks around the world try to slowly wean their economies off of the ultra-accommodative monetary policy that fueled the recovery. Donald Trump has publicly criticized the Organization of Petroleum Exporting Countries, or OPEC, for what he calls excessively high oil prices. Trump tweeted today, quote, "Oil prices are too high. OPEC is at it again. Not good!" Exclamation point. Close quote. The OPEC countries have reduced their collective output in order to boost prices to counter a flood of natural gas in the world market driven in large part by fracking in the United States. The United States, Mexico, and Canada have won their joint bid to host the 2026 World Cup. The three countries beat out Morocco and won two-thirds of the votes at the FIFA Congress. There's fierce competition between countries to enjoy the benefits of increased tourism and prestige that come with hosting a World Cup, but there is frequently grassroots opposition to the displacement of the poor that accompanies preparations. Those are today's headlines. Next up is coverage from Singapore and further analysis of the U.S.-North Korea summit. You're listening to Loud and Clear.
Loud and Clear.
But first, we turn to the results of the historic Trump-Kim summit in Singapore and the reaction globally. We're joined from Norfolk, Connecticut by Patrick Lawrence. He is the author of Time No Longer, Americans After the American Century, and a columnist at The Nation. You can support his work at www.patreon.com/theflautist. And we're joined by Brian Becker, the co-host of this show, who is in Singapore to cover the summit. Welcome to both of you.
Thank you very much. Thanks.
Patrick, let's start with you. Let's start by talking about the media reaction to the summit. There was a positive declaration that came out as a consequence agreed to by Kim Jong-un and Donald Trump. How do you rate the reaction of the mainstream media, especially the media in the United States?
Right. Well, Walter, that's all I've got because I'm in America. I wasn't able to go to Singapore. So the American media is the sort of the center of my universe for this event. Very poor. Surprisingly poor. What we've got over here is a perspective that can't speak its name, right? The liberal media, and indeed liberal political figures and so forth, are opposed to a negotiated settlement in Korea. That's just that. But they cannot say that. So you get into this thing the Americans always indulge in, the language being spoken beneath the language, right? And it has been more or less uniformly negative, but quite subtly. You know, there are 100 things wrong with what Trump did. Example one, very prominently. Well, there are no details here. Would you please excuse me? This was an historic meeting between two heads of state after nearly 70 years of hostility, and the big problem with getting a piece of paper signed between them for the first time in all these decades is that they didn't go into detailed plans for denuclearization, human rights, chemical weapons, missiles, and all the rest of it. I mean, it's what I've been listening all morning in anticipation of our encounter here. People are basically at a loss as to what to say. Weeks ago, I began wondering aloud in my columns, what are the liberals going to do if Trump pulls this off? And now we know. Contempt for Trump, forgive the phrasing, contempt for Trump trumps a peaceful solution of an exceedingly critical, dangerous crisis in one big corner of Asia. That's what I'm hearing this morning.
I think that's right. Another thing, too, is you're seeing the opposite happening now among members of Congress and other members of the chattering class. I again made sure to scan the morning news shows, and you had the likes of James Clapper, for example, saying on CNN that this was an historic meeting, that Trump may actually pull this off, that we have to give him credit for it. I was shocked. And then on MSNBC, it was Chris Coons, the senator from Delaware, saying essentially the same thing. Tom Cotton, who's the far right wing senator from Arkansas, said that he hated to admit it because he would prefer to destroy North Korea, but that this looked like it was actually heading down the path of peace. The reaction is astounding to me. I just assumed before they even met, before Trump and Kim even met, that in the event of success, everybody would be happy. Like, how is this in any way a negative thing?
Yeah, I find the more pernicious quadrant of opinion over here, John, to be the liberals, I'm afraid. They worry me more than Trump and all the negative things one can indeed say about Donald Trump. We are getting into a zone where liberal imperialism is becoming very seriously consolidated as a policy. I mean, I was wondering yesterday, I read an item on Mother Jones, of all places, okay? The columnist says, Donald Trump just abandoned the South Koreans. First of all, if anybody did any abandoning, it's the South Koreans abandoned the United States. They was one of the great historic aspects of what's been going on in Northeast Asia for some months now is that Asians have usurped control of the Korea crisis from Washington in the first time in 70 years. So I read this item and I said, it is a long way from opposition to the Vietnam War. These are the descendants of those of us who were on barricades and writing against the war. And they've made a complete loop around to opposing peace in Northeast Asia, and I do not think that is too strong a phrase to describe their position.
Brian, go ahead. What do you think? The Democrats seem to once again be actually to the right of Donald Trump on this issue, both the Democrats in Congress and the Democrats in the corporate media.
That seems to be the case. One of the things that really grabbed me about the, you know, I'm here in Singapore. There are 2,500 other journalists who are part of this accredited International Media Center. Most of the people were from Asia, most of the journalists. There were some other countries from, I mean, other places outside of Asia represented. But the American reporters, they were yelling out to things to Donald Trump, like one of them yelled, "Do you consider Kim to be your equal?" And Trump sort of said, no, but, well, I don't know. Well, what do you mean? But the correct answer was, of course, the politically correct answer was, no, of course he's not my equal. Here you have the, quote, liberal media shouting out without embarrassment to Donald Trump, do you consider Kim Jong-un, a North Korean leader, to be your equal, knowing that the only acceptable answer is no? As if no, other people are less equal. You can't get more racist than that. And it's almost all these affluent, white, middle-class men who think they know everything and who, in fact, know nothing, yelling racist epithets as if Donald Trump must, in order to get their approval, yell back, of course, this Korean is not my equal. I mean, it's really disgusting. And you know, the other thing that they're now lampooning Trump for is that he's meeting with a dictator, that he's not talking about human rights abuses in North Korea. Well, I want to just say a few words about that. I mean, none of these same media seem to be bothered when Donald Trump is meeting with Mohammed bin Salman and he's being wined and dined, maybe not with the actual wine, but certainly dined and treated. I mean, they're not demanding that Trump repudiate the dictatorship of Saudi Arabia, nor with Netanyahu, while the Israelis, who are the largest recipient of U.S. aid, shoot thousands of unarmed Palestinians. That's not a big deal. And just a couple other things. Isn't depriving the people of North Korea of food and medicine, like the draconian economic sanctions, isn't that kind of a violation of their human rights, like the right to have food and the right to have medicine? Or just to think back more about these kind of lampooning of Trump because he's meeting with North Korea. I mean, you know, during the Korean War, every day, according to most military estimates, the United States dropped 250,000 pounds of napalm on North Koreans every day. How can a country that did that to the North Korean people then turn around and say, oh, we are the champions of their human rights? I mean, we've reached a low level in terms of the media coverage.
Very good. Yeah. I mean, what comes over on this side, Brian? First of all, I'm very happy to hear you use the word racism. It's implicit in all of this. It's a 21st century version of Hearst's Yellow Peril. It really is, going down a few levels, of course. But what comes through on this side, perhaps Walter and John agree, is how out of touch Americans are with realities on your side of the Pacific. We have no idea the dynamic that is driving the initiative Moon Jae-in, the South Korean president, began literally the week he took office, May of last year. No idea of it. It appears, I mean, the way the papers are behaving, somehow it is considered wise and productive to deflect realities as they come at us because they're not palatable. Right. If I may add one more thing, in the line of your account of the press conference, shouting, people shout, reporters who want to know better, shouting at Trump. My favorite yesterday was a commentator who said the sight of the American, a liberal commentator indeed, saying the sight of the American and North Korean flags next to one another was, quotation marks, gross.
I think the corrective for that would have been Kim Jong-un should have met with Donald Trump, and there should have been only American flags, and there should have been big pictures of George Washington, and then the two of them could have gotten up and said the Pledge of Allegiance to the American flag. Maybe that would have been appropriate.
What I think is happening here, at least in the U.S. press, is rather than reporting on the news, rather than reporting on developments as they happen, the press, whether it's from the right or the pretend left, the neoliberal left, they've decided that they have a certain narrative, and they're trying to make the news, they're trying to make the summit fit into their narrative. Both of you were just talking a minute ago about human rights, about food, about medicine. That is never, ever mentioned in the U.S. mainstream media. No one talks about starvation in North Korea or the lack of medicine, ever. It's just not, it's been deemed by the mainstream media to not be newsworthy.
We have a textbook case of the imperative of forgetting if America is to proceed on its chosen way in its conduct abroad, certainly in Northeast Asia, but of course elsewhere, we know that, right? We must forget. Remembering would be devastating to those who advance the story you described, John, right? The nation are forgetters. We must remain so.
One other thing I want to agree with Patrick, and you know, I was doing some research while I was here, again, going back to the Korean War, because now since the American media is so, you know, they're so embracing human rights, but they don't want to talk about the fact that the United States has been trying to strangle the people of North Korea, deprive them of food or medicine, or to have any accounting for what the U.S. did during the Korean War. So I went back and I looked, and I found a quotation from General LeMay, Curtis LeMay. Now, Curtis LeMay was in charge of the bombing campaign of North Korea between 1950 and 1953. Curtis LeMay in 1968 was a George Wallace's running mate in the 1968 presidential campaign. So an embracer of segregation and racism. LeMay said this about what they did, what he and the other American generals did in the Korean War. He said, we went to war there and we burned down every city and every town and every village in North Korea. That's a quote from Curtis LeMay, or I might be off by a word or two, but that's the essential quote. And then he estimates that bombing campaign killed 20% of the population of North Korea. Now, just think of what 20% of a population means. In the United States, we have, what, 320 million people? Well, 20% then would be, let's see, that would be 60 million people. That would be the equivalent of killing 60 million Americans. And just saying we burned down every town and village and city in the United States. I mean, that's what the American war makers talked about, what they did to North Korea, and that's not a human rights violation.
On this program, Brian and John and Walter, when I'm privileged to be one of your guests, we often talk about history, and I don't think it's a coincidence. We talk about the past, the background of whatever given event we're discussing, right? It is the best thing a program like this can do is remember. It's a very essential task, and this is a perfect case.
Brian, I want to take it in a little bit of a different direction, if you don't mind, because we're running out of time here, and there are a couple really important developments related to the U.S. military exercises. There seems to be a great deal of confusion and probably a really intense internal struggle within the United States government. Mike Pence called a group of Republican senators yesterday, and Senator Cory Gardner reported from that phone call that Mike Pence assured them that the military exercises were in fact still on. These are the joint U.S.-South Korean military exercises that simulate the invasion, the destruction, sometimes the nuclear destruction of North Korea. But then the vice president's spokesperson came out and said, oh, no, no, that's not what the vice president said. I mean, what's going on here?
The press is leaving out. They mention it once and then leave it out. It's falling off the story already. Trump said, we will suspend military exercises for the duration of the negotiations, providing the negotiations are proceeding in a good direction. That's quite different than what we're now reading. What we're now reading is that he just canceled them altogether. Not true. Right there, you have a big problem, right? So we're not getting a proper account of things. Second, they are not. There's a confusion between the major war games, a legitimate term, and routine training exercises. Those are another matter altogether, and they will proceed. That's part of the confusion, too.
Go ahead, Brian.
I think those are important words to clarify the situation. There's a war going on right now. There is an ongoing war that's gone on since 1950 between the U.S. and North Korea. But the war I'm talking about is the war that's going on inside the political establishment in Washington, D.C., and inside the United States. Because the majority opinion of the elites within the Pentagon, within the military-industrial complex, within Congress, and certainly within the media, are opposed to Donald Trump going forward and consummating this agreement with the DPRK. They are opposed to it. By the way, Raytheon and the other defense contractors are probably also opposed to it because their stocks immediately lost a lot of value yesterday after the Trump-Kim summit.
Yeah, between 4 and 8%.
Yeah, billions and billions, tens of billions of dollars of lost value. Because guess what? Peace is bad for business in America. War is good for business. And so there's a lot of incentive for the military-industrial complex. Another lobby. So you have the Democrats against this deal. The Republicans really against the deal. Big parts of Trump's cabinet, like Mike Pence or Bolton, probably against the deal. The General Mattis and the Pentagon and the military-industrial complex against this deal. There's a lot of headwinds that Donald Trump is facing. And so the question when he says, hey, look, these war games are a waste of money and they're a provocation and they're dropping bombs all over the place, as he said at the press conference, that's treated with unmitigated horror by all of these sectors of the military and political reactionary establishment, but also by the liberal media who say, oh my God, how can we stop these war exercises? Isn't that this unbelievable concession to the DPRK? Can you imagine any other country in the world coming off the shores of the mid-Atlantic where Loud and Clear is right now, Washington, D.C., or New York, or San Francisco, or L.A., and carrying out with huge B-1 bombers, B-2 bombers, B-52 bombers, or their equivalent weapons, nuclear-capable weapons, and simulating the nuclear destruction of Washington, D.C., miles from Washington, D.C. Can you imagine the reaction? Well, that's what the United States is doing to DPRK twice a year, and Donald Trump actually knows that by saying, look, we're going to cancel or have a moratorium, as Patrick properly put it, a moratorium on these war exercises as long as the negotiations are going well. He knows that that would make a genuine difference for North Korea instead of having to put their entire country on full alert and divert all of those resources as they do twice a year. They can use that money and that energy for other things that people actually need. So Donald Trump was actually trying to say something to the DPRK, and the consensus opinion almost with exception, maybe the exception being Donald Trump in Washington, is that that's a bad thing.
I just want to add one more thing in here. Patrick, we'll give you the last word. We've got just a little bit under 2 minutes left. Donald Trump said that there is no longer a nuclear threat from North Korea. I mean, this is the same guy who went to the rostrum of the United Nations and say, we will totally destroy North Korea, allegedly on the pretext of their nuclear threat. So how do you react to both what Brian just said and to this newest comment from Donald Trump?
Let's clarify terms here, Walter. Well, I don't think we should talk about a North Korean nuclear threat. We need to talk about a North Korean deterrent. That's what this has been all about from the very beginning, going back to the latter decades of the last century. These notions that it wants to send a nuclear weapon to the coast of California and so on and so forth, ridiculous overstatement and fear-mongering. It has been all about a deterrent, and I am here once more to encourage your listeners to celebrate with me the fact that North Korea has a nuclear weapon, because it is proven to be an effective deterrent. That's why we are on the phone talking right now.
Brian, just about 30 seconds left, last minute.
Yeah, let me jump in too. Yeah, Patrick's completely correct on that. If North Korea had not developed nuclear weapons and a missile technology capability to reach the United States, these negotiations would not be going forward. What North Korea is doing with the negotiations is it's saying very clearly, loudly and clearly, we needed to do what we did, even though it cost us a lot because of economic sanctions, in order to get America to come to the table. And what they really want now is not war, they want peace. And what peace means to them, first and foremost, the first step is normalization of relations with the United States and an end to the war that began 68 years ago this month.
We're going to leave it right there. We've been joined from Norfolk, Connecticut by Patrick Lawrence. He's the author of Time No Longer, Americans After the American Century, and a columnist at The Nation. You can support his work at patreon.com/theflautist. And we were joined from Singapore by Brian Becker, who's been there covering the Trump-Kim summit. You're listening to Loud and Clear. We'll be right back.
Loud and Clear.
You're listening to Weekday World on CPR.
Loud and Clear.
Welcome back to Loud and Clear. I'm Walter Smolarek, filling in for Brian Becker.
And I'm John Kiriakou.
Today, we're going to continue our regular segment, Beyond Nuclear, when we look at nuclear issues, including weapons, energy, waste, and the future of nuclear technology in the United States. We're joined from Michigan by Kevin Camps, the radioactive waste watchdog at the organization Beyond Nuclear. And we are joined in studio by Sputnik News analyst and producer Nicole Roussel. Welcome back.
Hey, thank you.
So, Kevin, we've had a bunch of news come up in the last week. I think the biggest that I'm really interested to get your take on. So secret meetings between NRC and FERC? What's happening?
Yes, well, the Nuclear Regulatory Commission and the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission do meet from time to time. It's been over a year since their last meeting. Usually the meetings take place in public. There are some behind closed doors sessions for things like cybersecurity or terrorism risks, that kind of thing. But in this particular circumstance, given the timing of the Trump administration trying to bail out coal and nuclear power plants to the tune of up to $17 to $34 billion per year, this latest meeting last Thursday between NRC and FERC, the closed-door session is very suspicious, because even during the public session, one of the FERC commissioners, Powelson, seem to be pressuring the NRC to decrease its safety regulation, to weaken its safety regulation, in order to save the industry even more money on top of the bailout. So who knows what got said behind closed doors. We filed a Freedom of Information Act request, a number of groups, Beyond Nuclear, Public Citizen, Don't Waste Michigan, Sierra Club, trying to get at what happened behind those closed doors.
Let's pull back for a second, too, and talk a little bit about, so the Nuclear Regulatory Commission specifically works with nuclear regulations, and then FERC, the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission, I'm probably getting those names wrong, is a little bit broader and deals with a lot more energy regulations. Do you want to talk about maybe what those two groups normally handle and kind of why this is such a problem?
Sure, yeah. NRC is explicitly limited, supposedly, by law, to nuclear power safety regulation. They're not supposed to care about how much it costs to maintain adequate safety. They're just supposed to maintain it through their enforcement actions. And it's kind of a bad joke at this point, because the NRC is entirely captured by the nuclear power lobbyists. So it's weakening regulations left and right, even after the Fukushima nuclear catastrophe showed what that can lead to. So that's NRC. They're guilty of nuclear power promotion, which is a direct violation of its mandate. And this goes on both under Democratic and Republican administrations, only now with Trump's latest additions to the Nuclear Regulatory Commission directors. It's going to be a very ugly dark age coming in terms of nuclear power safety regulation. The FERC, the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission, is broader than just nuclear by far. It's also overseeing coal generation, natural gas generation, oil generation. So things like pipelines, for example, went before FERC, fracking issues. And what FERC's responsibility is grid reliability and free markets. And they've been priding themselves for many years now on, you know, capitalism, free markets. We're trying to only let the best competitors in electricity generation succeed because that's their, you know, their victory in the capitalist marketplace. Well, all of that is up for grabs at this point, given Trump's really absurd proposal to bail out coal and nuclear massively. And I, in previous weeks, have used figures like $8 billion per year to prop up old atomic reactors. And then last week, I think I used the $11 billion figure. Well, the latest news from certain experts like Peter Bradford, a former Nuclear Regulatory Commission commissioner and a former state regulator with public service commissions in New York and Maine, is putting the figure at more like $14 billion per year just for the atomic reactor bailouts. And then you'd have to add another $14 billion for the coal bailouts. And the group Nuclear Information and Resource Service has been tracking this for years. And so their best estimates are that it could be up to, I'm sorry, I misspoke, it's $17 billion actually. So it could be up to $17 billion on atomic, $17 billion on coal, for a grand total of $34 billion per year that electric consumers and American taxpayers could be paying as a subsidy.
We talk a lot on this show about the different revolving doors that exist at different, you know, levels of the government or different areas of the government. You know, we talk about the military-industrial complex and how former Pentagon officials frequently get, you know, very lucrative jobs at these big defense and weapons contractors and vice versa. We talk about we were just talking about net neutrality, how the repeal of net neutrality has gone into effect and how telecommunications industry lobbyists are just riddled all throughout the Federal Communications Commission. We talked about a few weeks ago on this show the interplay between the big think tanks and the U.S. State Department and how private interests are able to influence U.S. foreign policy through those mechanisms. I mean, I'm sure there's a very similar revolving door between the nuclear power industry and the Nuclear Regulatory Commission and FERC as well, right?
Oh, man, that's why I said a new dark age at the Nuclear Regulatory Commission. So Trump's latest nominees, who just got Senate confirmation last week or the week before, include David Wright, who's a former South Carolina Public Service Commission chairman. And his claim to infamy is that he presided over the approval of massive ratepayer gouges on electric consumers' electric bills in South Carolina. And then last summer, the two new reactors in South Carolina that were under construction got canceled because of the bankruptcy of Westinghouse Nuclear, because of the massive cost overruns, the long schedule delays. And that is a $9 billion with a B loss to South Carolina electric ratepayers with nothing to show in return. That was David Wright down in South Carolina. Now he's on the Nuclear Regulatory Commission. And another development is that the state of Nevada, which has fought for a generation to stop the Yucca Mountain dump targeted at it for radioactive waste disposal, they're going after David Wright. They're demanding his recusal from any Yucca dump-related matter, because when he was on the National Association of State Regulators, called National Association of Regulatory Utility Commissioners, he was the Yucca Mountain guy. His job was to try to promote Yucca Mountain as a dump. And so they say he has a conflict of interest. He has to recuse himself. So there's an example at the Nuclear Regulatory Commission. Another one at NRC is Annie Caputo, a former senior congressional aide on nuclear power matters on behalf of the industry, because before she came to Capitol Hill, she was an Exelon lobbyist, the biggest nuclear power utility in the country. So, you know, the industry and its friends control the Nuclear Regulatory Commission. That's long been the case, but it's worse now than ever.
But even still, you know, even with this revolving door that you and Walter were just talking about, even still, we still see FERC saying they don't actually need the bailout. So it's just a little bit insane to me that, you know, this large bailout of an extraordinarily dangerous and dirty and polluting coal and nuclear plants is getting pushed from pretty specifically only companies, and is getting some traction. I wanted to read from piece from Beyond Nuclear. I thought this was a really good point. It says the Trump administration is also attempting to justify the bailouts under provisions of the Defense Production Act of 1950, as well as the FAST, Fixing America's Surface Transportation Act. Such major federal government interventions via the FPA or DPA are rarely undertaken and usually only for wartime emergencies or natural disasters. No such emergency action has been taken in Puerto Rico after Hurricane Maria, which a recent Harvard University study reported could have resulted in around 5,000 deaths, many due to the widespread power outages, some of which continue still nearly 9 months later. So, I mean, this is just another reminder that, you know, if you don't have a lobbyist backing you, if you don't have millions of dollars backing you, you are not going to be saved.
Yeah, and this particular scandal, it's a real swamp monster scandal going on here. On June 1st, Bloomberg News broke the story due to a leak from the National Security Council. There was this 40-page memo that was laying the groundwork for this Department of Energy bailout of coal and nuclear. And there was about to be a meeting the next day at the National Security Council about this subject matter. And I just reviewed that memo again because it lays out their Federal Power Act and Defense Production Act and FAST Act arguments for bailing out coal and nuclear. And it just dawned on me to check for the words Puerto Rico in this 40-page document. And surprise, surprise, the Trump team did not include the words Puerto Rico. It's incredible because they give all these examples of natural disasters and even extreme weather. Of course, they don't mention climate change or global warming, but they say things like severe weather, extreme weather. Well, guess why that's happening? They won't say it out loud, but there is not a single mention of Puerto Rico. There's lots of examples given of previous natural disasters that impacted the power grid. Not one peep about Puerto Rico. And another major part of the swamp monster scandal is this lobbyist named Jeff Miller, who is very close to Rick Perry, the energy secretary, an old friend. In fact, ran his presidential campaign in 2016. Now he's an energy lobbyist. He's been hired by First Energy in Ohio, the originator of this absurd plea for bailouts. And he's getting paid $110,000 a quarter. And he has managed through a private dinner with Trump several weeks ago to get traction on this. And so Trump has now ordered Rick Perry to make this happen under these various laws. And it, you know, it couldn't be a worse swamp monster scandal.
The climate change denialism, I'm glad you brought that up. I mean, among all the other topics that we're considering here, when it comes to energy policy, I think the dominant thing, I mean, in addition to the price, right? I mean, people don't want to pay exorbitant prices for their energy. But people also, I think, associate it correctly with the climate crisis and with climate change. Rick Perry is in charge of the Department of Energy. He's been a key player in this bailout that we've been talking about. And he is a climate change denialist. I just want to remind everybody that about 1 year ago, Rick Perry went on CNBC and he was asked by the host what is responsible for rising temperatures around the world. Is it carbon emissions, is what the host asked. And Rick Perry said, no, most likely the primary control knob is the ocean waters and this environment that we live in. I mean, who knows what that could even possibly mean? You know, it's really a profoundly dangerous thing for the world, for people who, you know, have such contempt for basic science to be in charge of these crucially important global decisions, like where do we get our energy from?
I think he is taking a page out of the book of that delightful representative who said that the ocean's water was rising because rocks were falling in it.
Rocks and sediment.
Oh, sorry, rocks and sediment. That's a great point.
And, you know, that's another just incredible disconnect from reality that's going on here is, guess what? In a destabilized climate, nuclear power cannot operate. I mean, for example, as surface waters increase in temperature, nuclear power plants depend on surface waters for cooling purposes. And there's going to come a point, and there has been many examples of this over past years, where the surface waters, it used to be inland surface waters, including rivers, especially because they're so low volume compared to the ocean, for example, where they had to shut down nuclear plants because the rivers were not providing cooling. And then it moved to the Great Lakes. So in southwest Michigan, where I'm sitting right now, the Cook Nuclear Power Plant had to shut down several years ago, over a decade ago, because Lake Michigan, of all surface waters, was too warm to cool the reactors. And we've even seen it on the oceans. So that's less of a safety and more of just an efficiency thing, but it still shuts down nukes. Then you get extreme weather conditions due to climate destabilization, and that's what increases safety risks. So they have to shut down the atomic reactors because they can't operate when there's extreme weather going on, because it could lead to a meltdown and a Fukushima-level radioactivity release. So Nicole earlier said, you know, even FERC is taking a stand against the need to do this bailout, and they're backing up the PJM grid, the largest grid in the country, serving 65 million people, which has reported consistently, even within the last few days, that even if First Energy's four reactors in Ohio and Pennsylvania shut down, even if an equal number of First Energy coal plants shut down, there's going to be no impact on the grid. And so that's the level of disconnect that's going on.
So interestingly, we are also seeing at least one very large coal burner, AEP, also not supportive of the bailout. And that one I am having a really hard time wrapping my head around. Kevin, do you have any idea why AEP is coming out against this?
Well, AEP, American Electric Power, which is based in Columbus, Ohio, it's really hard to wrap your head around because they would presumably be a beneficiary of these bailouts, because they not only have a lot of coal burners, they also have a nuclear power plant. It's called the Donald Cook Nuclear Power Plant in southwest Michigan. I just mentioned a minute ago that it shut down once because Lake Michigan's water was too warm to provide cooling. And it has had major safety risks over the years, too, I should add. But, yeah, it's interesting. You know, there are some strange bedfellows jumping on the opposition to Trump and Perry's bailout for First Energy. More straightforward ones, like major manufacturers who are going to have to pay an exorbitant electricity bill, just like households will if this bailout goes through. And then you have competitors to First Energy, other electric generators who are not getting a bailout, you know, like the natural gas industry, the renewables industry. So American Electric Power, I haven't had a chance to study the reasons why yet, but I think a part of it is just the smell test. Like, they're doing okay. Another aspect of it is they are making a transition. They're going from more than two-thirds coal power in their portfolio to more natural gas and a lot more renewables, to their credit. We sure wish they would shut down their nuclear plant before it melts down, but they're taking strides to try to, you know, join the 21st century. And because of that, because their renewable division, for example, is not getting any bailout, because their natural gas division is not getting a bailout, they're probably taking a position where, hey, look, you know, coal and nukes, if they can't compete, they need to shut down. And in fact, there's a quote in that article about American Electric Power where the CEO says, hey, look, if our coal plants are not economic, and we review this all the time, we're going to shut them down. And it's because they're replacing them with more cost-competitive generators.
Yeah, and I think, you know, no, coal especially has gotten a pretty bad rap in this country recently, at least. And I wonder if just, you know, no company, electric or natural gas or renewables, wants to be on the same side as coal. I mean, that's just not a good look.
And the coal magnate, Robert Murray, who makes his money on mining and selling coal to coal burners, he's the one who, as best we know, first came up with this idea to use the Federal Power Act, Section 202, Subsection C, to bail out coal and nuclear now under wartime or natural disaster emergency conditions. So that goes back a year ago that he was putting that forward, and now we have First Energy, which is a major coal burner and a major nuclear utility, just adding to that idea. But it's very, very special interests who are pushing this, and they've got Trump's ear.
So we do have some good news, though, right, Kevin? Last night, Bernalillo County passed a resolution in opposition to Holtec and ELEA. Is that correct? Am I getting that right?
Yeah, this is the Holtec high-level radioactive waste dump targeted at southeast New Mexico. And Bernalillo County is the home of Albuquerque, the biggest city in the state. And it's adding to this drumbeat of New Mexico opposition. So you've got the city of Albuquerque. Now you've got the county, Bernalillo, that is where Albuquerque is, and you've got a number of smaller towns down in southeast New Mexico, which are putting the lie or the truth to any claim that this facility is consent-based. There's a lot of talk about consent-based siting. Well, apparently New Mexico does not consent, no matter what this company Holtec or this municipal coalition called the Eddie Lee Energy Alliance in Southeast New Mexico have to say about it. So it's really great, and we've really got to expand those resolutions against these proposals across the country along the transportation corridor routes, the roads, the rails, the waterways that would be used to move highly radioactive irradiated nuclear fuel. And we've really got to redouble our efforts, because just yesterday we learned that Waste Control Specialists Limited Liability Company in West Texas, only 40 miles away from the Holtec site across the state line, is now hitting the play button on its suspended licensing proceeding. So now we're facing two of these de facto permanent parking lot dumps on the surface moving forward at the same time in the Nuclear Regulatory Commission licensing proceedings.
But this isn't the first time that Texas has pushed back, though. I mean, last year, you guys have reported that Midland, Dallas, and Bexar counties have taken similar action as New Mexico against another waste dump. Do you think that they can do that again? Do you see that happening?
Yeah, the resolutions are spreading across both New Mexico and Texas because they're the most targeted. And in those counties you mentioned in Texas are, you know, somewhat removed from the targeted dump site. And really, their major concern is the transportation of the highly radioactive waste through their communities. The same with Albuquerque and with Bernalillo County. They're not targeted for the dump site itself. They're targeted for the transportation routes to the dump site. So that's the hope, is that just as with Yucca Mountain in past years and decades, where we got resolutions from across the country, that will spread and we'll put a stop to all these bad ideas, including, yet again, the Yucca Mountain dump, which the Trump administration and House Republicans especially are trying to resurrect.
Why are people opposed to the transportation of nuclear waste through their areas? I mean, like, what's the worst-case scenario? What is the type of disaster that people are trying to avert with these types of measures?
And Kevin, before you answer, we are on our regular Wednesday segment right now, Beyond Nuclear with Kevin Camps, and we're joined from Michigan by Kevin Camps, the radioactive waste watchdog at the organization Beyond Nuclear. Kevin, go ahead.
Well, we've long called these potential shipments mobile Chernobyls after the Soviet nuclear disaster in 1986. We also refer to them as floating Fukushimas because of proposed barge shipments and dirty bombs on wheels because of the security risks. So the worst case scenario is this is the same material that exploded and burned at Chernobyl, the same material that melted down and escaped into the environment at Fukushima. It's highly radioactive, irradiated nuclear fuel, the most radioactive, the highest radioactive waste there is. And now it's going to be moving by truck, by train, by barge through major urban centers, places like Chicago or St. Louis, or you name the city. 44 states in the U.S. Are documented as on transportation routes to Yucca Mountain, Nevada, the proposed permanent burial site. The temporary site, so-called, in Texas and New Mexico, the proponents, the companies, and their government backers have been very coy about what the transportation routes are. They're making us figure that out. Surprise, surprise. They don't want the transport corridor communities waking up to these potential safety and security risks. So the safety risks include severe accidents, things like high-speed crashes into immovable objects like bridge abutments or falls off of a height like a bridge onto rocks below. There's also high-temperature, long-duration fires that could breach these containers. There's also breach scenarios for deep underwater long-duration submersions. And in that last category there, you could even have water get in and cause a nuclear chain reaction. There's still enough fissile material in the waste. That would make emergency response, like trying to raise the container out of the water, a suicide mission for emergency responders because of the neutron and gamma radiation that would be streaming out, as well as the releases of radioactivity into the water. So in addition to all that catastrophic scenario stuff, there's also routine shipments that are still like mobile X-ray machines that can't be turned off. They will be emitting gamma and neutron radiations through their walls. And people along the routes, who live along the routes, or innocent bystanders like at a railroad crossing as the train goes by, are going to get either, you know, short term or longer term, if the train stops and idles there and they're sitting there next to it, doses, which, you know, if there's a pregnant woman in a car close to one of these containers, that is not good, because any ionizing radioactivity exposure to a fetus in the womb carries very significant health risks.
Kevin, let's turn to another big topic when it comes to the nuclear issue in the world. Right now, we've been talking primarily about nuclear energy, but when it comes to nuclear weapons, in Singapore, Donald Trump and North Korean leader Kim Jong-un held this historic summit. There was, you know, even though the details weren't all worked out, there was a positive final statement that came out of it, whereby, you know, there would be a denuclearization of some type of the Korean Peninsula, and in return, the United States would agree to cease some of its hostile, aggressive acts, provide security and economic guarantees. We've been talking about this all week. You know, the normal co-host Brian Becker is actually in Singapore right now. What is your reaction to what happened there? We've been talking about how shocking it is that most of the corporate media in the United States is like upset at the resolution.
Well, certainly diplomacy is preferable to war. That's pretty obvious. But I mean, one of the criticisms I am hearing is, okay, show me, you know, like they say in Missouri. So, okay, denuclearization. We have seen some actual concrete steps taken by North Korea. The destruction, supposedly, although it was, there were no specialists or experts or even the International Atomic Energy Agency brought in to witness the destruction of its nuclear test site, the collapsing of tunnels used there. But there were journalists allowed to view it and to witness it and to document it. So that's a positive thing. What it's going to mean is, you know, very concrete steps, like have been taken in Iran, for example, of pouring literal concrete into an atomic reactor used for plutonium production in Iran. So we have to see that happening in North Korea, or at least an agreement for that happening by date certain, and the introduction of inspectors, verifiable inspections, and that remains to be seen. So I think, you know, I would give some credence to the criticism that words on paper, especially with the North Korean regime, are suspicious, because they have backed out of these agreements in the past. They've cheated on them in the past. And so, you know, it's going to take actual concrete steps. I would just leave it at that.
Right. Well, I would like to see the Trump administration also agree to some of those concrete steps. I mean, the United States, the only country in the world to have ever actually used nuclear weapons in combat. And that's, you know, against a completely unarmed civilian population. So we'll have to see where that whole process leads us. I mean, it's going to be a very long period of negotiations and back and forth. We only have a couple more minutes left. In these last few minutes, we've been talking about, you know, all of these negative developments, how, you know, these corporations, these nuclear corporations are able to exercise such tremendous influence, you know, the possible catastrophic consequences of nuclear waste being transported through communities all across the country. What is the positive vision? How could the U.S. electrical grid, how could the environmental regulation regime in the country, how could all of these things change? Like, what should be done to make sure that people have affordable electricity, comfortable lives, safe lives, and, you know, democratic rights to control the communities that they live in?
That's the irony of this Trump and Perry bailout of the coal and nuclear industries. They're trying to make an argument for resilience, which really means coming back from either a extreme natural disaster or a weather event or even terrorist attack upon the electricity grid in this country. And they're turning to coal and nuclear for that. And I mentioned the extreme weather threats to nuclear, but there's also the terrorist attack threat to nuclear that could take out a time zone, like we've seen in Japan from a natural disaster. Well, terrorism could do that. And so the good news is, you know, if Trump and Perry and First Energy are so concerned about keeping the lights on after a major event of some sort, you know what could do that is solar and wind and energy efficiency that is widely distributed geographically, microgrids. That is real resilience, where, you know, businesses provide their own electricity. Everybody is self-reliant. And so that is reliability. That is resiliency. And it's growing by leaps and bounds in this country. Solar, wind, tremendous job growth, Even in Texas, where Perry's from, he got out of the way as governor, and tremendous wind growth took place. Like, world-class wind growth took place in Texas under his governorship because he got out of the way and let it happen. So here he is as energy secretary, essentially trying to sabotage renewables by bailing out massively their competitors of coal and nuclear. So that's the hope, and that's the future, if we're going to have one, is renewables and efficiency. And countries like Germany have gotten that for a long time, and they're making it happen.
Are we seeing any slowdown on the growth of renewables in this country with the very different administrations? I mean, the last administrations weren't perfect on nuclear, definitely weren't great on nuclear, in fact. But in terms of renewables, there was definitely significant funding for R&D for renewables. Are we seeing any change in that with this administration?
Well, I think in certain places for a long time now, for years in Ohio, there's been a pretty effective sabotaging of renewables, like wind especially. So that's at the behest of First Energy nuclear lobbyists in the state capital in Ohio. In terms of the federal level, you know, it depends on if Trump and Perry get away with this absurd bailout. It would certainly have dramatic impacts on renewables. It's opportunity costs. If we're going to be gouging the American people to the tune of $34 billion a year in platinum-plated electricity costs, they're not going to have any money left to, you know, help promote renewables and make renewables happen. So that's the opportunity cost. They say all of the above in terms of energy. Well, that's stupid. Why would you choose failing energy industries like coal and nuclear and support them? Shouldn't you choose the best ideas like renewables and efficiency? So that's the flaw of all of the above. There's only so many energy dollars. People also have to, like, eat and, you know, pay for housing and that kind of thing. So if we're going to bail out failing energy industries with our treasure, we're going to have no money left for other things.
And it's a total myth that those would be job-killing measures, right? I mean, people can also get, you know, there are plenty of jobs out there and certainly would be plenty more jobs out there if there was a concerted push to build renewable energy sources all across the country and or even the world.
Yeah, these are incredibly small numbers of jobs now in coal mining, for example, or in nuclear power plant operations. Very relatively small numbers of people. But it's taking away the potential for orders of magnitude more jobs in the renewable energy sector. So there are real consequences to these absurd proposals.
We're going to have to leave it right there. We've been joined from Michigan by Kevin Camps. He's the radioactive waste watchdog at the organization Beyond Nuclear. Go check out their work. You're listening to Loud and Clear. We'll be right back.
Loud and Clear.
You're listening to Weekday World on CPR.